We're continuing our little studies today in the life of Elisha, the man of God. And I invite you to turn to 2 Kings chapter 2. As we go back into history, even prior to what we looked at in this morning's messages, we're actually going to look at just three verses tonight in training hour at the end of chapter 2. But to give you a little of the context, let's go back a little further to verse 8. And here we have both Elijah and Elisha together. One's about to leave in a most remarkable way, and one's about to remain and carry on his unique prophetic ministry. So verse 8, notice, and Elijah took his mantle, his cloak, and wrapped it together, and they were down by the Jordan River, so he smote the waters, and they were divided hither and thither, so that they too went over on dry ground. So did you realize that the parting of this body of water took place more than once? We had the Red Sea parting. We had the Jordan River parting in the days of Joshua at flood stage. And now we have Elijah parting the Jordan River, and they crossed on dry ground. Of course, this time it's only two men that crossed, the two prophets. And then in a bit we're going to see a fourth parting. Verse 9, it came to pass when they were gone over that Elijah said unto Elisha, ask what I shall do for thee before I be taken away from thee. He said, Elisha, what do you want me to do for you? So here's his request. Elisha said, I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me. A double portion. I want to be a man of God like you. And remember, in the inheritance of the children of Israel, it was the firstborn son that got a double portion. So if there were four sons and there were five pieces of land, let's say, each of the sons would get one portion of land, but the firstborn would get a double portion. He'd get two portions of land. And that's how it worked for the oldest son. Verse 10, and he said, thou hast asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if thou see me when I am taken from thee, it shall be so unto thee. But if not, it shall not be so. If you see me removed from earth, then your request will be granted. Verse 11, it came to pass as they still went on and talked, that behold, there appeared a chariot of fire and horses of fire. And the fire, you know, represents the very presence of God. Remember in the Israelites, the cloud by day and the fire by night, God was present with his people. And parted them both asunder, and Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. He didn't die, he just went up. Now there's a rule, a general principle. It is appointed unto men once to die, and after that, the judgment. But there's two exceptions to that rule. Here's one of them. Elijah went up, never died. What's the other exception? Enoch, right. Enoch was taken, was translated that he should not see death. He was, and then suddenly, he was not. There's actually a third exception. What's that? A whole generation of believers who are alive at the coming of the Lord will be caught up to meet the Lord in the air, and they shall not see death. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep. So what an amazing end of his earthly life for Elijah. So verse 12, Elisha saw it. He did see it. And he cried, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. And he saw him no more, and he took hold of his own clothes and rent them in two pieces. And he took up the mantle of Elijah that fell from him and went back and stood by the bank of Jordan. Now we have the fourth parting of the waters. He took the mantle of Elijah that fell from him and smote the waters and said, where is the Lord God of Elijah? And when he had also smitten the waters, they parted hither and thither, and Elisha went over. So for the fourth time in man's history, God did a remarkable miracle of parting a body of water. Once the Red Sea, three times the Jordan River. So this is the context. Elisha is now God's man. He has the mantle of Elijah. He realizes that God's stamp of approval is upon him to launch out and to be God's special prophet. But our verses this morning begin in verse 23, 24, and 25, the last three verses. So again, let's read these together as a group. Verse 23, and he went up from thence unto Bethel, and as he was going up by the way, there came forth little children out of the city, and mocked him, and said unto him, go up, thou bald head, go up, thou bald head. And he turned back and looked on them, and cursed them in the name of the Lord. And there came forth two she-bears out of the wood, and tared 42 children of them. And he went from thence to Mount Carmel, and from thence he returned to Samaria. You say, George, you're sharing with us some awful passages today. And I agree. This is a very difficult passage in many ways. And there's some problems here that we need to solve. Lord willing, we'll do that. But in a few moments, I'm going to read for you a commentary on these verses by Robert Ingersoll, the noted agnostic, or the famous unbeliever of the 19th century. He lived about the same time as Dwight L. Moody. In fact, he died the very same year as the great evangelist. But he was an American. He fought in the Civil War. But he was famous for his unbelief. And he would actually lecture to thousands of people to try to persuade them against faith in the God of the Bible. The story is told that at one point he got up in front of a large audience and gave them a challenge, or actually gave God a challenge. And it was a challenge for God to prove his existence. He said something like this, if there is really a God in heaven, let him strike me down dead within the next 5 minutes. So he pulled out his pocket watch and started counting the seconds. And you can imagine the audience was very, very tense. And you know how long 5 minutes can be when you're waiting? Do you know how long 2 minutes can be at the beginning of worship service when you're all quiet and no one's saying a word before Steve gets up? Sometimes a minute can seem like a long time. And the minutes ticked away. At the end of the 5 minutes, he says, you see, I proved it. God does not exist. Now, maybe someone should have gone up to Mr. Ingersoll after that occasion and said something like this, Mr. Ingersoll, do you have a son? Now, I don't really know if he did or not, but let's assume for the sake of argument that he did. He says, yes, I have a son. Mr. Ingersoll, suppose your son were to do a very foolish thing and get up in front of a group of people and say, I want to prove to you all that my father does not exist. If my father really exists, let him slay me within 5 minutes. Now, Mr. Ingersoll, if your son were to do such a foolish thing like that, would you kill him? No, of course not. Well, why not? Because he's my son, and I love him. Well, Mr. Ingersoll, did it ever occur to you that perhaps the reason God did not slay you dead is not because he doesn't exist, but because he might love you? And you know, there's another reason why God did not strike him down dead immediately. God is so very long-suffering, isn't he? And in this age of grace, God is even very long-suffering toward those who wickedly blaspheme his name. You know, if God were to strike down every person that blasphemes his name, there'd be people dropping all over the place. Now, later in Ingersoll's life, and here's the interesting thing, God did strike that man dead. It happened in the year 1899. That man's life came to an end, and God struck him dead. He died of congestive heart failure. You say, now wait a minute. He just died from physical problems, from a bad heart. God didn't do it. No, God is involved in the death of every single person. No matter what the cause of death, God's hand is in it. And there are no accidental deaths, and there are no deaths from natural causes when seen from God's point of view. He holds the keys of life. He holds the keys of death and Hades, doesn't he? Now, we just read this three-verse passage about the two bears and what they did to a group of what the King James says, little children. And I'd like to read for you what Robert Ingersoll, the unbeliever, said about this incident in his exact words in one of his lectures. Now, I warn you, this is blasphemous. This is horrible. I find in this Bible that there was an old gentleman a little short of the article of hair. And as he was going through the town, a number of little children cried out to him, "Go up, thou bald head." And this man of God turned and cursed them. And two bears came out of the woods and tore in pieces 42 children. How did the bears get there? Elisha could not control the bears. Nobody could control the bears in that way. Now, just think of an infinite God making a shining star, having his attention attracted by hearing some children saying to an old gentleman, "Go up, thou bald head," and then speaking to his secretary or someone else, "Bring in a couple bears now." What a magnificent God. What would the devil have done under these circumstances? You hate a God like that. I do. I despise him. Blasphemy. He despised the God who would have done such a thing. Now, what was his problem? Well, his first problem was he did not really understand the passage he was criticizing. What does God say? The natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness unto him. The natural man, the unsaved man who does not have the Spirit, cannot and does not understand the Bible. Period. And he had a few misconceptions, as indicated in his paragraph. He thinks that the bears mauled little children. We're going to find out that was not the case. Secondly, he thought Elisha was an old man, which was not the case at all. Elisha had just began his ministry, a ministry which would last 60 years. And Dr. Whitcomb estimates that Elisha at this time was about 25 years of age, a young man. And very often those who criticize the Bible don't even understand the Bible. I'm going to give you an example of a young college student by the name of Stephen Thorpe. Now this goes back. You want to hear a story about Stephen Thorpe while he was at Wesleyan? Who wants to hear this story? He's downstairs taking my class, so I'm free to say whatever I want. All right. Now, Steve lived in a dormitory situation where there were like 8 rooms. Each man had his separate room, but they shared bathrooms and they were kind of together. And one of his roommates was a very bright young man. He was the editor of the school of the university newspaper called the Wesleyan Argus. And I forget his name, but he was the editor, very intellectual young man. And Steve was one of his roommates. And Steve loved to share the Lord whenever he could, and they had a discussion. And this young man got frustrated one day, and he said, "Listen, Steve, the Bible is not true. How can you believe this book? It's just not true. And it's full of contradictions." So Steve said, "Oh, that's interesting." So he very quietly took a walk, went to his room, picked up his Bible, brought it back, and said to the student, here's the Bible. Could you show me one of those contradictions?" And of course, the guy didn't know what to do with the Bible. He didn't know where to turn, where to look, where to find anything. And it was just a wonderful way that Steve dealt with that, but it was also a wonderful illustration that those who criticize the Bible usually don't even know the Bible and are ignorant of what they're saying. Now back to Ingersoll. What was his real problem in that horrible quote that I gave you? He says, "I despise that kind of a God." Well, he had a problem with a God who judges sin. And a lot of people have that very same problem. A problem with a God who actually judges sin. And our society has that problem. We don't believe that sin should be punished. We don't believe that wrong should be punished. What case just came up in the Connecticut legislature? They wanted to abolish something. Capital punishment. Can you believe that? And do you realize how serious that is? Do you realize how clearly God has spoken on that issue? That after the Genesis flood, he said, "Whoso sheddeth man's blood," Genesis 9:6, "by man shall his blood be shed." Whoever sheds man's blood, whoever murders, by man shall his blood be shed. The murderer should be put to death by the proper governmental authorities. And now we're trying to abolish capital punishment in Connecticut. But you know what? We actually abolished it a long time ago. Because even though it's on the books, it's never carried out. And when was the last time a murderer has been put to death in Connecticut? Well, it was actually in the year 2005. His name was Michael Ross. But do you realize that that was the only case in the last 49 years? I wonder if we've had more than one murder in the last 49 years in Connecticut. We live in a society where evildoers are not appropriately punished. And even when they are, it's not usually done swiftly. We also live in a society where people are punished if they spank their children. When I grew up, I had loving parents who never abused me physically, but who did hurt me physically at certain times. And I was personally acquainted with the rod of correction. The Board of Education was applied to the seat of learning. And I knew what it was. I knew what it was to be whacked on the back of the tender legs with a hard rod by parents who loved me. And you know what? I deserved every blow that I received. And I got far fewer blows than I deserved. I deserve worse than I got. But I'm thankful that I had parents that taught me that when you do wrong, you deserve to be punished. And that wrong behavior was serious and it deserved punishment. So in our passage tonight, we learn that wrong, sinful behavior is subject to the judgment of God. Now, verse 23 of 2 Kings 2. And he went up from thence unto Bethel, and as he was going up by the way, there came forth little children out of the city. So the first problem we face here is how old were these little children, as the King James describes them? How old were they? When I think of little children, I think of a 5-year-old, 6-year-old, 4-year-old. Well, let me help you out with this. It's the word children is the Hebrew word lad. Na'ar is the Hebrew word. Now, let me show you how this word is used. Genesis 37. It's used of Joseph. Genesis 37 and verse 2. These are the generations of Jacob, Joseph being how old? 17. Was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the what? The lad. That's this word. So here is a child, a lad, 17 years old. He's in his late teens. Now, second example is that of David's son Absalom. And look with me in 2 Samuel, chapter 18. And verse 5. And the king commanded Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, deal gently for my sake with the young man. Now there's this expression, young man, this lad, even with Absalom. Now here's the interesting thing. This is the chapter where Absalom dies. Remember how he died? His long hair got tangled in a tree and got caught and so forth. Now, he was not a little child at that point in his life. This is his death. He had gone through many years. He had rebelled against his father. He had tried to be king himself and led a tremendous revolt against King David. And Dr. Whitcomb estimates that he was in his 30s and he's called by this word lad. Let me give you the final example. Solomon. Look in 1 Kings chapter 3. Verse 1 Kings chapter 3. And verse 7. And now, O Lord, my God, thou hast made thy servant king instead of David, my father, and I am but a little child. I'm just a little lad. So he had just become king. Do you think Solomon was 5 years old when he became king? 7 years old, 9 years old? No, he wasn't. He was much older than that. Now back to our passage, 2 Kings chapter 2. Verse 23. Little children. So we've looked at this word children, the word lad, and we've seen that it can indicate a person that's even much older than a teenager, a late teenager, or someone even in his 30s. Someone the age of Solomon when he became king. But there is the word little before it, or the word young. He was a young, these young children, these young lads, these youths. So even if you put the word little before it, if you've got a young, it's not 30 years old, it's younger than that, you're still going to end up maybe teenagers. Maybe young people that are 12 to 15 years old, maybe even older. And that's what he's talking about here. He's not talking about little beginner children, little primary, first, second, third graders. These were perhaps young teens. They were old enough to know what they were doing. They were old enough to maliciously mock the man of God. These were apparently young delinquents from the city of Bethel. They were of age. They were accountable. They were responsible for their actions. They were fully aware of their actions and responsible for them. And what city were they from? Verse 23, Bethel. Now you need to know something about Bethel. Bethel was a center of wicked idolatry in this time in Israel's history. And to remind you of that, look in 1 Kings chapter 12. 1 Kings chapter 12. And verse 28. Is talking about King Jeroboam, the man responsible, or the man who was on the throne at the time the kingdom was divided. And it says, verse 28, whereupon the king took counsel and made two calves of gold, and said unto them, it is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Now God had required that Jerusalem be the center of worship. But this king is rebelling against God's place and setting up his own religious system with new centers of worship. Not just one, but two centers of worship. And he made two golden calves. And he says, behold thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. And verse 29, he set the one in Bethel up in the north and the other in Dan. Down in the south. So Bethel was a seat for Baal worship, for idolatry. It was an idolatrous headquarters in Israel. And these young men were from that idolatrous city. And it's even possible that the calf-worshipping priests had sent these young delinquents on a mission to discredit and humiliate Elijah's successor, who was Elisha. These were not innocent children. They were rowdy teenagers. This was not a group of playful children making a clever joke, but it was a gang of at least 42 of them who were smart aleck youths maliciously ridiculing God and God's servant. Now back in 2 Kings 2. These young youths came out of the city, and it says they mocked him. They scoffed at him. They made fun of him. And here was their mocking. They said, "Go up, thou bald head. Go up, thou bald head." Well, so we have to ask the question, was Elisha bald? Possibly so. Now, remember, he was a young man. He was only about 25. They mocked him for his baldness. So he could have had premature baldness. Some people at a young age get that. Or possibly he could have cut his hair very short and giving the appearance of baldness. Or perhaps he had very light-colored hair, whitish-colored hair. Is a bald eagle bald? Not really. It has white feathers. We're not told exactly what Elisha's head was like. We just don't know. All we know is he was mocked and he was made fun of because of baldness. And there must have been some reason they mocked him for that. You know, it's a terrible thing to make fun of a person who can do nothing about it. Make fun of a person for some physical trait that they have no control over at all, that they didn't ask for, and they can't change. But things like that, of course, are done all the time. Whether Elisha was prematurely bald or not, the point is this, that out in the East, in Bible lands, even to the present day, the expression bald head is looked on as the very worst term of insult. It's used as a word of insult. It's used as a term of smite, a slime, a venom, and the implication of despicableness makes it the lowest of insults. The expression "thou bald head" was a term of extreme contempt, and baldness was a sign of God's curse. Now remember, when you insult God's man, who are you insulting? God himself. Notice in verse 3, verse 23 of chapter 2, it says, "There came forth these youths out of the city." And that seems to suggest a planned attack, not just a chance meeting. They came forth. They seem to be deliberately headed for the prophet to mock him and do what they did. Also in their mocking, they said, "Go up." Now, what did they mean by that? Go up. Well, it's possible that they were mockingly challenging him to go up to heaven just like Elijah did, as recorded earlier in this chapter. The idea would be this: if you are a man of God, why don't you get out of here and go to heaven the way Elijah did? We're glad he's gone, and we hope you will get out of here as well. We hope you will follow him and get out of here. Go up. You know, it's a terrible thing to disrespect our elders. And these teenage delinquents, although not hugely younger than Elisha, they were younger, and they disrespected him greatly. And they disrespected the God whom he represented. But you know, God is not mocked, right? "For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap." And in verse 24, it says that Elisha turned back and looked on them and cursed them in the name of the Lord. Now, that does not mean he used inappropriate language and swore at them or used foul language. It does not mean he used profanity. He cursed them. It's the opposite of blessing them. You know, instead of saying, "May God's blessings be upon you," he cursed them. "May God's judgment be upon you." In this case, he cursed in the name of the Lord. God was involved in this curse. It wasn't a case of Elisha losing his temper and spouting off obscenities or wicked language. No, he was God's prophet, and he spoke and cursed in the name of the Lord. He pronounced judgment upon them. And judging people is God's business. It's not our business. You know, it was not Elisha who brought the bears. It was the Lord himself. Now, we're not told the actual words of the curse. It could have been something like this: "Let the judgment of God be upon you," or "God reward you according to your deeds," or something to that effect. "And there came forth two female bears out of the woods and tear 42 children of them." We don't know how many there were in total, but 42 of them were torn by two bears. Isn't it amazing how God uses animals for his special purposes and how they perfectly obey him and carry out his orders? Remember one time the children of Israel were murmuring in the wilderness, and God commanded fiery serpents, poisonous snakes, to come forth and head right for them, and many were bitten. Just amazing how God uses his creatures. I wish we could obey God as faithfully as the animals do. The wild beasts obey him. Remember the old prophet of God? God sent a lion out to meet him one day. Now, 42 of them were injured and torn by the bears. And as I've thought about this, it seems like something supernatural was taking place that allowed so many of them to get injured. Because there were only two bears. And under normal situations, if two bears come out of the woods, there's a whole group of children, and they start attacking several of them, what are the rest going to do? Take off as fast as they can fly. But somehow and in some way, God contained this group of children, and the bears were enabled to get to them exactly as God wanted. I don't know how God did it, but the Bible says he did it. Now, the Scofield note, if you have a Scofield Bible, says it was an infliction of serious wounds, but does not mean kill or destroy. Now, let me say, I don't know if these children were killed. It doesn't actually say that. But I do know what the word tear means. And tear 42 children of them. Here's what the word means. It means to cut to pieces, to tear open. And in Genesis 22, remember Abraham sacrificing his son, it's used there of cutting firewood into pieces. And let me show you one other place it's used, which is very horrible. It's in the same book of 2 Kings, chapter 8. And verse 12. Now look at the end of verse 12. It talks about slaying with the sword and will dash their children and rip up their women with child. Now the horrors that took place in warfare in ancient times were unbelievable. And here we have the case of pregnant women actually being ripped up. And that's the word tear. To rip up, to tear open, to cut to pieces. So like I said, I don't know for sure if these children died, but from the meaning of that word, if they were only injured, it seems surely that the injuries were very, very severe. Now, why did God do this? And by the way, if God were to send bears every time people mock his man or God himself, again, there'd be bears coming out of the woods all over the place. Second Chronicles, let me take you to two places as we close. Second Chronicles chapter 36. Chapter 36 and verse 15. And the Lord God of their fathers sent to them by his messengers, rising up betimes and sending, because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place. And God's explaining why he sent the children of Israel into captivity. Verse 16. But they mocked the messengers of God. They mocked God's prophets and despised his words and misused his prophets. Elisha was God's prophet, and these young people mocked him in a terrible way. And God judged them. But one more place, which is very remarkable, and it's in Leviticus chapter 26. Verse 21. Now read this with me and see if this is not an exact fulfillment of what we just read in Kings. God told them that it would happen. If you walk contrary unto me and will not hearken unto me, I will bring 7 times more plagues upon you according to your sins. I will also send wild beasts among you, which shall rob you of your children and destroy your cattle and make you few in number. There were people in that wicked, idolatrous city of Bethel who were robbed of their children exactly as God had predicted. 3 little verses. Reminding us that there is a God in heaven who judges wrongdoing, who judges sin, and a very sobering and serious passage. But how thankful we are for the mercy of God. And that's my final statement. Thank you. You're dismissed.